Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Ernest McMillan, author of the memoir Standing, One Man's Odyssey Through the Turbulent 60s. Ernest McMillan is a veteran human rights activist with a history of working through the 60s in Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, better known as SNCC, and throughout the 80s with the National Black United Front and the United League of Mississippi. McMillan served as chairman of Dallas SNCC from 1967 to 1969. He is deeply involved in the work of connecting arts with the community and developing avenues to foster and engage multi-generational, multicultural bridges for community uplift. And Ernest, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking forward to this day. I appreciate the time you're sharing with the public about the book. Thank you.
Well, I'm really honored to have an opportunity to finally talk to you. As we've shared in our conversations, I heard about you, met you briefly a long time ago when I lived in Houston, knew about the great work that you've done. And I think, you know, the stories that you tell are really important considering where we are today. And there is a tendency for history to repeat itself. Now, not an exact repetition, but it seems eerily like there's a way that if you look at where we are today, that the clock is being moved back in a different manner or so, but the clock is being moved back. So I want to start off with asking, why at this point in time did you decide to publish your memoir, Standing?
Good question, Hopeton. I've been reluctant to publicize any of my works throughout my life. I've worked as a journalist with high school newspaper and in prison newspapers, writing essays and things like that, but never anything personally about myself. At one time I was with a group of friends and we were having a circle, just a discussion. And when someone asked me to talk about what I've been going through, and after I concluded the conversation, they approached me and said, "You need to write this down. You need to share this history." I felt I wasn't worthy of that. I felt like my story didn't need to be told. Then I began to reflect on that. At least my children and my children's children need to know that. So I began to write in earnest to pass on to my family, especially what I'd gone through. So there's something they could recognize, and maybe some of the mistakes I made, maybe some of the things I've learned could be applied to their lives in some way. So I was encouraged by friends, especially family and close friends, to write. And they gave me support and feedback, and that encouraged me to finally do so. And then the pandemic came along, and nobody wanted to entertain any new publishing ideas. So I thought about self-publishing. But I was really proud and grateful to learn that there was a publisher in Dallas who was introduced to my work and decided that he would go ahead and do so. So that's with Deep Vellum Publishing Company, and Will Evans, who's the publisher, took me in. And they also said, "You got a companion book?" And I said, "Yes." They said, "We'll do both of them at the same time." And that was just blew my mind. So I have my poems and short stories, which is called Kneeling, along with Standing, coming out simultaneously. So I'm just grateful for all the stars aligning, universe coming forth and lending support to these efforts. So that's kind of how it is in a nutshell.
Your activism actually started in high school. You were part of the NAACP Youth Committee, and you came from an interesting blend of family. You're right that the Partees and the McMillans were a rich and colorful blend of city life on one side and country life on the other. Community activism on one and church activism on the other. How did these two different views of the role of the Black community and your families help to shape you as a leader in SNCC?
Oh, I guess being in a segregated community, being in one that's holistic in a sense of everything I needed being right there, just providing a nurturing basis for my life. I felt, looking back now, I didn't really appreciate it so much then, but we were living in a liberated zone. We were protected and sort of like it had a refuge in our community, which was called Freedmanstown. So growing up in a more intact community, having loving parents, my mother and her side of the family that was active in civic affairs, And my father's side of the family, which was active in church affairs, just kind of worked together, I guess, melded it together and influenced me in ways I wasn't even aware of it at the beginning. And now I'm really even more appreciative of the contributions they made. My mother especially worked daily in the community for her brother's organization, which he was executive secretary of the Progressive Voters League. In those days, you had to pay to vote, a poll tax. So her part was knocking on doors, educating people and setting up payment plans. So people had to cough up all the money at once. They gave recommendations for voting slates and things like that. She worked at the polls. So I would see her working 12 hours a day at the polls. And her life was devoted toward that, along with her brother and her other brothers, my uncles and my aunts too, who were actively supporting that whole effort. Two of those brothers were involved in education, public school, teaching history, and they brought that to our home. So we had competitions, we had conversations on a regular basis, talking about world history, about what was happening locally. We got a chance to express ourselves and play games, and got a chance to record our art style, whether it be funny, comical, or music-wise. So those kind of experiences, and kind of a home that was kind of like a community center, just kind of came together in ways I've just began to realize that helped shape me more and more to who I am today, and gave me the kind of confidence to dare to step out of the normal, expected, traditional pathways that were set for us by others.
How did being part of the youth chapter of the NAACP Dallas branch help to shape your view of what we needed to do as a community to move ahead?
The youth council was a vital part of the neighborhood, and it was more of a chance for socializing with others. We had teas, we had competitions, we had ways to get together and celebrate, have parties, and things like that. But there's another side of it, led by Juanita Kraft, who was the matriarch of the NAACP in Dallas, who led the youth council. And she dared us and challenged us and supported us to take a stand against segregation. In those days, you couldn't go downtown to try on any clothes. You had to take what they gave you. There was a colored signs all over the place with water fountains and seating on buses. And so we took a stab at what about the movie theaters. And the youth council was authorized in a way by the local NAACP to take a stand on at least one day a week and protest at what we call a stand-in. So the stand-in was where we would go to a particular theater. In this case, it was the Majestic Theater in downtown Dallas that allowed Black people only to sit in a certain section, which is the lower section. And so our mission was to go and demand interest and pay for a seat where everybody else could sit. And they would refuse us politely. We'd go back to the end of the line and try it again for several hours during the day on a Sunday, dressed in our Sunday finest. There was also the existence of the State Fair of Texas, which is highly segregated, where it allowed only Black certain days, if not more than one or two days, called Negro Achievement Day, to come and be able to participate in all the activities of the state fairground. And so I think it was in the late 50s, maybe 57, 58, when the NAACP, especially the Youth Council, formed a boycott of the state fairgrounds. It was done in a dramatic way with the local high schools, Lincoln High School especially, marching to the parade grounds and marching to the state fair exhibits. When they rushed the entry gate, everybody stopped and nobody went inside. We turned around. And so there was also conversations and negotiations going between Black business leaders, the NAACP, and the white government officials and fair park owners to find a way to accommodate people. And so after those, the demonstration was kind of like the tip of them that flipped it to finally desegregate the state fairgrounds. So being a part of those modest efforts, in a way looking back, just kind of gave me the internal resolve that we can make a difference, we can make changes, just need to step out and do what we can. So the NAACP Youth Council was a very big part of my early life in getting involved in the community organizing and community affairs, especially confronting the power structure to demand equality.
So you moved to, after graduating from high school in 1963, you moved from Dallas to a small town close to Atlanta to stay with your father, who was a pastor, to attend Morehouse. And your community activism ended up putting you in a little bit of a dicey situation out there, right?
Yes, those were hot times for a young man coming out of high school. The March on Washington was being planned that summer, and people were organizing toward it. Megan Evans had been shot dead in his front yard by a cowardly assassin. Four young girls were burned up and blown up to bits in Birmingham. The march to segregate and the demonstrations led by young people in Birmingham especially were making a difference and resonating in my heart about what's happening. And so I'm leaving high school, going further to the Deep South, and finding that people were just kind of apathetic or unknowingly participating in just business as usual. And so I went there just talking about the March on Washington in the early summer months and encouraging people to find ways to support the march by let's put some money together and send somebody to Washington, or let's sign a petition of support. And the word got back to the city officials, especially the deputy sheriffs and the police who knocked on my father's parsonage door and said, "Your son is causing trouble here. That's going to come back to hurt somebody. We don't want to see anybody get hurt. So we need you to get him to stop and refrain from doing these kind of activities he's doing in our community as agitating people to fight and organize and participate in unlawful activities." So I was kind of stigmatized as a criminal in the police mind. And my dad was fearful of my life. And so he put me on a train back to Dallas, saying, "When you come back to school, don't come here. Go straight to Atlanta for the freshman orientation." And soon after that, he actually had to leave the church himself. And he ended up in Atlanta himself in my freshman year at Morehouse. So that was probably all connected to my activities there. He never said that, but I think the church officials bent to the pressure of someone associated with the civil rights movement in the Methodist Church in Noonan, Georgia, which is only 30 miles south of Atlanta, has been unheard of and not going to be tolerated. So I think my father lost his position there, as well as my being booted out of the town because of those activities in Noonan.
Well, I think it's what's really remarkable is the incredible courage, Ernest, you showed and your peers showed. Because today, and we know there's danger today, but the danger during the 60s when you were organizing in Georgia was much more palpable. It was much more institutionalized to a much greater degree. Talk about that feeling of your passionate support of you and your peers at SNCC before we go into how you got into SNCC, because that was an interesting story there. You hearing a soundtrack blasting a message over and over again to call to join the fight against segregation and to defeat Lester Maddox's violent stance against integration. But the tremendous courage that you and your fellow activists show is just amazing at such an incredibly young age.
Yeah, two of my roommates were from Birmingham, Alabama. They graduated from Parker High School. They were one of the thousands of young people that confronted police dogs, fire hoses, all kind of tortures and imprisonment for just marching and expressing their outrage for being mistreated and being second-class citizens. So just meeting those guys and hearing their stories and them joining me to go downtown to protest the segregation of a restaurant, which was run by a gentleman, I can't say gentleman, a man who became the governor of the state of Georgia, Lester Maddox. So his restaurant was one that was highly restricted of anybody coming other than white people to get served. He had pick handles lined up on his wall so his customers could feel free to grab a weapon to beat up anybody that came into the store, to the restaurant rather, that were not white. So the kind of brutality was emanating from that restaurant, along with the reception from black people that this is not going to happen on our shift as our generation, and just stood up against it. So I marched alongside others who were marching around that restaurant. It was a 7-day, 24-hour demonstration. People were being arrested routinely. And so joining that march and then meeting those people who were leading that struggle were mostly young men and women from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So I began to learn more about them, gravitate to what they were doing. I began to volunteer at their headquarters, which was only about a half a mile from the Morehouse campus on 8.5 Raymond Street. And just that kind of encounter led me to pick up the phone in their SNCC office and answer calls from people in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, or Greenwood, Mississippi, or Little Rock, Arkansas, giving their reports of what was happening, what kind of things they needed, giving their verbal reports, and taking notes and learning those stories just kind of caused me to be saying, what am I doing? Just sitting there taking notes, you know? And so the next step was me to say, I want to become a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But SNCC was not a membership organization. They had 150 staff persons that were mostly young people who were working in the Deep South from Virginia all the way to East Texas, and what we call the Black Belt counties, and organizing voter registration drives, trying to fight against the disenfranchisement and the exploitation of Black people throughout those counties. And so to become a field secretary required a signed statement by the parents if you were under the age of 21. And I was.
And let me jump in here real quick, because I think the interesting side of that story for me is you had to get permission from your parents. You got your father to sign it. You got your mother. You talked to your mother over the phone.
Right.
And it's just tremendous that your parents, knowing what you were going up against, but knowing the importance of the work that you were doing and knowing your passionate commitment to this work, signed off on you getting involved with SNCC. But your father did tell you about what to expect.
They both did. They both were very anxious and apprehensive and cautioned me not to make that move. You know, they said I was jeopardizing my career and becoming a lawyer or some kind of professional and so forth. They cautioned me. They weren't just saying, go, go, go. They were actually saying, son, you need to think about this. And my dad said, before I do anything, talk to your mother. And my mother had the same kind of concerns as he did. But the bottom line was, when they wanted to know how I felt and what I was thinking, they said, look, if this is really in your heart, this is what you really think you're called to do, go, so you'll have our blessing, but be careful. But they signed on to me to go based on their reluctance, but understanding that I was strongly feeling this. It wasn't something just passing fancy with me.
Your first mentor, you say, was Willie Ricks. And he was the first person to issue the call for Black Power. So talk a little bit about that transition. We know much when you read the history of the Civil Rights Movement, the startup of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They're sort of an offshoot of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, if I have that correct. But kind of going down their own path with a much more, a different approach to the movement. And then with the Black Power being added to it, talk about that experience of this call for Black Power back in the late 1960s.
Yes, my first assignment for a permanent base was in Southwest Georgia. The Southwest Georgia project was run by a gentleman by the name of Charles Sherrard, a very brave figure who courageous in every sense of the word, and a sharp leader as well. And we had bases in several counties throughout Southwest Georgia. One of them was Lee County, just north of Albany, Georgia, which was based in Daugherty County. And so that's where I first met Willie Ricks. He was a veteran, had been there many seasons and working to organize voter registration campaigns. And three or four churches had burnt to the ground by Klans or white supremacist groups, because the church was where we organized and had what we call mass meetings or mass rallies, and would get people to sign up to go downtown to actually vote. So despite all this terror and this rain, in fact, Lee County was one of the most notorious counties in the country for carrying out levels of lynchings and tortures against Black people from antebellum days. And so meeting Willie Ricks there and being at his side as we go from door to door, walking or riding a horse or riding a bus and meeting people, and their response being, I want to vote, you know, I want to register. They didn't actually say register, they said reddish. I want to reddish. And they called us freedom fighters, and they associated themselves with the freedom movement and wanted to make a change. And they saw how power was in the hands of a few people when they were the majority. And they thought that was unbearable to continue living those kind of lives. So they risked their farms, they risked their lives, they risked their livelihood for just daring to go downtown and say, I want to vote. And so they encouraged me. They inspired me. How can I be shy when these folks are ready to go and I'm just driving a bus? You know, they're risking their homes, their life, their whole way of living by doing this. So it was that kind of encouragement, knowing ordinary citizens, ordinary people, humble and hardworking, devout spiritually and so forth, took a stand. And so that just kind of revved my spirits up too. And then what we saw in the Deep South was that nonviolence was a tactic for SNCC. It wasn't a way of living. We believed in self-defense. We and the farmers and the people we worked with in the Deep South had guns and protected us. In fact, in Mississippi, where I worked for several months on farms and sharecrop housing, people would actually watch the gates and watch the land and protect us while we could rest and regroup ourselves. So if a car came inside their property and didn't have the right kind of blinks on the headlights, they could be shot down. And so there was a code for getting inside the property, and they had men and women with guns who would be stationed around the property and would protect. They became our freedom homes, our freedom houses. And so having that kind of backbone, I guess is the way to call it, having that kind of sense, common sense of self-defense as being necessary, and then seeing people being killed, shot down routinely. It was the summer of 1964 when three SNCC workers were murdered. I had a dear friend by the name of George Best out of Tallahassee who was run off the road and his car overturned. He drowned to death in his car because it was in a river that his car landed. So those kind of things were just saying enough is enough is enough. And when the James Meredith March Against Fear took place, and I think it was June of 1966, out of that march, we got to see community rising up and wanting more. Dr. King joined James Meredith and joined Stokely Carmichael and others in that march from, I guess, hundreds of miles throughout Mississippi. And that's when the cry for Black power was ushered out by Stokely and Willie Ricks. And the response was that, yes, it's about time, you know. So the whole thing about the power of the United States government was based on the disenfranchisement of minorities, especially Black people in the Deep South. The people who ran the halls of Congress, who were the senior chairmanships for the Appropriation, House and Ways Committee, the Armed Forces and so forth, were out of the Deep South. And the reason they were continuing being reelected and reelected and gaining seniority is because the counties they came from were majority Black, but none of the Black people could vote. So the white minority was being elevated and lifted up and in control of the whole government of the United States of America because of the Deep South had those kind of power based on seniority. And so that's why we focus on the Black Belt counties and begin to organize our own political parties. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party grew out of that as well and challenged the so-called traditional Democratic Party delegates in Atlantic City in 1964. But Black Power was one learned by experience and by actual encounters and knowing that we need to do more than just march and pray. We need to organize for power. We need to have a consciousness about who we are as a people. So the whole thing about our consciousness, our right to self-determination, not simply to sit beside somebody at a lunch counter or to ride on a bus on the same seat level they are, but more about the control of government, equity in democratic governments to have voting power and be represented accordingly. So it was political, economic changes that Black Power was speaking to, as well as awareness and education. So those three levels were crystal clear, but fear, and I think with the government response was creating repression, even more repressive regime, because something was brewing, something was happening, was catching on, not only in the Black community, but in the Chicano community, in the Asian community, in the women's struggle, in the anti-war movement. There were coalitions developing. There was a kind of unifying force against the war. And King began to speak out, not about equality and racial relations, but talking about economics of war and the rule of racism and how it hurts and harms people not only domestically, but internationally. And so the whole thing was beginning to shift. A new coalition was forming, new organizations were arising, the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, the Young Lords, people, organizations like that began to not only come to rise, but to join forces together. It was SNCC and the Black Panther Party in 1968 that were merging together, becoming one. It was Dr. King talking to Stokely saying, "I see what you're saying. I'm coming with you." So those led to King's being assassinated, the Black Panther Party being criminalized, and SNCC being ostracized as well. And this was led by a program of the United States government called the Counterintelligence
Program. All right, let me jump in right here because I'm going to get to that. So, no, I mean, this is a great history. This because this is what, you know, this is what I'm looking for, history straight from someone that was there. But I do want to talk a bit about your decision to go home in 1967 to organize the SNCC, the Dallas chapter of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Okay, in 1966, there was a growing realization that we had made some real important changes. There were organizations now saying, "SNCC, you've done your job. You've helped us get the Voting Rights Act. You've helped us get the Civil Rights Act of 64 and now 65. And so these young people who were with SNCC can go back to school and resume their education. And we were offered scholarships. One of the groups that offered me a scholarship was the National Council of Negro Women. And they gave me a scholarship to return to school. And I jumped on that and went back to Texas to enroll in the school, the University State College, which is now called University of Texas at Arlington. And joining that campus and seeing a rebel flag flying over campus grounds and seeing segregated dorms said, "I'm not free. I'm not still not where we need to be. So we need to keep organizing." And we organized protests on the campus to fight against this white supremacist rule of thumb that said Black people are slaves and we are your rulers. And so I was expelled from the campus and I was put in the briar patch because I decided I'm free now to get more involved, not only in the war and fighting against the war in Vietnam and the anti-war movement, and organizing counselors to help young men see that they had rights not to just be marched off into Vietnam, that there's some things they could do legally and consciously to opposed the war. And so joining the anti-war movement and then seeing that we couldn't make any progress unless we get more organized in our own community. So that's when we organized the SNCC chapter in Dallas and began to organize there on a grassroots level to try to build consciousness, to try to get people more engaged in their daily lives about how the city has been run, how policies are being formed, and do something about it.
So let's talk about the law enforcement and the counterintelligence movement, the FBI, and how they had agent provocateurs and how they were trying to criminalize or push criminalize all the actions, the law enforcement at that point in time in the late 1960s, criminalizing your actions. You know, you talk about being charged with a felony for malicious destruction of private property over the value of $50. You talk about a cop giving you a ticket, even though you had not driven, as part of a harassment campaign to derail what SNCC and other activist leaders were trying to do in Dallas.
I think it was a conscious attempt from the top down to neutralize or to destroy a progressive movement, not just the Black Power movement, but all these movements that were beginning to come together. And the anti-war movement was one of the springboards. So on each one of these levels, the United States government under the FBI's leadership of J. Edgar Hoover conducted wiretapping campaigns, surveillance campaigns, misinformational campaigns, agent provocateurs to cause disruption in organization, skill levels and direction. All this thing was happening all at once. I'll give you a couple examples. There's an organization in California called the Black Panther Party. Another one's called US. And US was led by a Black group, is a Black group that was fighting for cultural revolution in our minds and hearts. And that's where the whole celebration of Kwanzaa came out of, that movement. But the Panthers and the US party, US organization, had different views and different programs and different emphasis and different values, but they had an opportunity and they carried out to work and do nonviolently to solve their differences. But the FBI used whatever differences they had to aggravate those and create more division. They would publish letters, false letters on Black Panther stationery, and same thing from US stationery, using those as pamphlets or evidence that they were going to war against each other and making provocative statements, calling each other out and threatening to harm each other. These were false things that were done. There were agents placed inside each one of these organizations that kindled those flames and rekindled those flames. In Dallas, we had agents ourselves in a broader organization that were trying to divide us in many different ways, from cultural organizations to political organizations. So we had our own things too going on. But I think the main thing was not only the internal structure, but where they would go through our trash cans, and or they would have microphones outside our house, listen to conversation, or they would tap our phones. But they were also creating false charges and bringing those to us. For example, in Dallas, we were handing out flyers at a public site where people just parked their cars and listened to music. We would pass out our newspaper called The Black Disciple and have flyers and so forth. There was a security guard that came up and approached us and said, "You guys cannot distribute this on this." I said, "This is America. This is not private property. We do it, so go to hell," kind of thing. "Leave us alone." So we were charged with threatening his life, brought to court for that. We had a demonstration against a supermarket in South Dallas, and some merchandise was destroyed, maybe $40, $50 worth of merchandise, but that was accidentally was, and they organized the thinking to say, this is a criminal activity led by two people, Matthew Johnson and Ernest McMillan, two SNCC leaders. And so each of those charges became a felony. I was supposedly testified against saying I dropped a gallon of milk in the store, a gallon of milk worth $1.09. I was sentenced to 10 years in prison for that. So it was the whole thing about we were the principal leaders in a riot in a store that caused over $50 worth of damage. So that's how they use the courts. I was charged with firearm violation. I bought a gun legally from a store using my driver's license, and then I was told it was illegal for me to do so. I was told by the official at my draft induction ceremony that you need to cool off. You kind of seem like you have to go home, and we'll call you back next month. I was charged with draft evasion for that. None of these charges were ever brought to court, but they were used to lock us up and to cause us to spend money to fight that, get hired lawyers and so forth. And then they would drop the charges years later because it never had any merit. So I'm just saying, this was not only happening in Dallas, but across the country, and not just with Black organizations either. And so we had 28 Black Panther Party members killed in 1969 by police. We had the Republic of New Africa and Jackson, Mississippi stormed and people wounded and killed. In Detroit, the Shrine of Black Madonna was attacked and burned down. You know, so we had all these kind of things going on all around us and orchestrated by these invisible hands from above out of Washington, D.C. through the FBI.
So ultimately, you were illegally, unjustly charged with these crimes. You ended up going into jail. You were on probation, I guess, waiting for the trial, and you got permission to travel. You got permission to travel. You had a process in place. You would ask permission. They would say, your lawyer would handle it. They would say, yes, you would go travel to speak. But then you were invited in June of 1969 to speak at the World Council of Churches in Greenwich, Connecticut. And your lawyer hadn't gotten the official approval, but told you that it was okay to travel to Greenwich, Connecticut to give the speech. And then afterwards, and basically it was a setup.
Yeah, the lawyer was not one we voluntarily paid for. It was a court-appointed lawyer appointed by the state who had no experience with criminal cases of this nature. He was more or less a tax accountant. Anyway, so that was an orchestrated conspiracy to get us either shot and killed or arrested for something we didn't do. I was traveling with my companion at that time in the stick, was Quasi Williams, who was also under indictment for possession of marijuana, which carried a life sentence. One matchbox of marijuana could cause you to be arrested for life, in prison for life. That was real because it was happening every day. Lee Otis Johnson, who was a stick chairperson in Houston, was given 30 years in prison for one joint. Stoney Burns, who was a publisher of the Voice newspaper in Dallas, was given 10 years and a day for having marijuana seeds in his ashtray. And these things were real. So we were fearful of the consequences when we learned after arriving in Greenwich, Connecticut, that our leaving Dallas was not approved. So we knew it was a setup right then and there. We figured out how can we save our lives? How can we make headway and risk it? Because the lawyer was saying, please don't take a regular plane, a bus, a train. Find a serendipity secret way to get back to Dallas. We said, no. We'll go north and come and regroup and figure a way out from there. And so we traveled from New York City after leaving from Greenwich to New York and made our way to Canada and eventually to Africa, where we were hoping to unite with our brothers and sisters who were already in Africa, like Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, and others who had dual citizenship in the Republic of Guinea. So our aim was to stay alive, to fight for another day, to regroup and come back to the United States, hopefully under different conditions. So that's how Quasi and I were traveling together secretly, using an unknown method for survival and trying to organize day to day just to stay alive and build an underground railroad as we.
But there was, once again, I'm going to overuse this adjective, remarkable, that network of activists and supporters that helped you to survive. That was just such a, the story you tell is just such a remarkable story about the goodwill that did exist out there for people who were supportive of the movement, supportive of the fight for rights and justice, and the just so many people helped you to survive those, what was it, 3 years, 2 to 3 years that you were on the run. That was, that had to, you had to have thought deep and long about that.
Oh, yes. I'm forever grateful for the angels in the flesh, I call them, that came forth. People we accidentally met, people we never known, people never been associated with any formal organizing, but who were at heart and soul with us and with the fight. So it leads me to believe even today that you might not see a great number of people marching or standing up or fighting, but there is a sentiment just below the surface of people who are heart really concerned and willing to die and fight for their rights, for their democratic rights, for their cultural rights, for the environment, for social justice. And those are the things that resonated with those folks, is that you're not doing anything wrong. You are a warrior for our rights and for our uplift. And so we support you. So it was, you know, people, not just of Black people, but of all races and ages, colors and sizes that came forth. Just, we may have met two or three people we never known before, but the majority of people we met were people we did not know. And that's all the way from the Bronx, Harlem, all the way to Halifax, Canada, to France, to Mali.
Carmen Bernardo. Carmen Bernardo in Chicago.
Oh yes, she was another one who was an angel in the flesh, who just her life was one just built for understanding and being engaged. She in the struggle, and she did this just, and not in a formal systematic way, but just through life experience, pick it up as she go forward every day in her life. So I'm glad you mentioned her name, because she was a woman I met as a fugitive. She didn't know I was a fugitive when we first met, but we got to know each other and begin to understand that on the south side of Chicago, we had a movement taking place. This was before Hampton was shot down and killed in his own home. This was the time of the Panthers and the Black Workers Congress, the League of Revolutionary Workers, all these different organizations. She volunteered to go to Cuba and become a part of Vincent Ramos' brigade. And that's when I first met her, when she returned and told us what she was experiencing. So it was the whole compound that she lived in was just a remarkable set of people who were either revolutionary minded or hustlers or scholars and deans in different universities or blue collar workers who provided a community of safety and comfort around us for many, many months.
But I can't talk to you without talking to you about being the adopted sons, you and Kwesi, of Ma Mary.
Yes.
Tell us about Ma Mary.
Oh, I could just read you a little piece about it if you don't mind from the book.
Oh, no, go right ahead.
Okay. Ma Mary was an African woman in Liberia who saved my life. And she was a woman who was a hero in her own village. She helped solve problems among relationships of people, domestic problems. She was called on to help mend lives and heal souls. And she healed mine as well. Because I came in contact with malaria and almost died. She saved my life by taking care of me and nurturing me for days through my fever, my delirium, and to come back. And I can't find that page right now, but so I just try to tell you basically, here it is. We met in Monrovia. I came to know her as Ma Mary. We quickly learned she was my Mary to many. She was a strange, wonderful mix, owning a rough, no-nonsense exterior, but kind and loving interior. By Liberian standards, she was a very dark, tall woman and heavy build. Ma Mary spoke several languages, including Ga, her principal language, and English. When she knew Kwesi and me better, she would tell us, "You know, go home to America. Stay here. This is your home now." She was an enigma, a deeply religious person who sold marijuana to survive, and a village elder statesman without portfolio. Though I'm not certain how we met, from our very first moments in Monrovia, she became a fixture in our lives. And so we met people like that. There was a Baptist minister in Monrovia who provided support to get back to the United States. There was a young group of Ghanaian men trying to make their way from Ghana to Germany to find a new way to support their families, to get jobs, introduce us to their families in Ghana who took us in. So everywhere I went, it was just countless heroes and sheroes that came forth. And I wouldn't be alive today without the love and care and concern of those persons.
One of the things you found perplexing was, despite all you shared with your compadres and as you traveled across Africa from Ghana to Liberia and on, that they still wanted to go to the United States of America, despite the fact that you were on the run because of the injustice and the racism and the supremacy that was going on, yet they still wanted to go to America.
That blew my mind. We would tell them about the lynchings, about the unemployment situation, about the racist attacks, all of these things. What if we finish this? Well, how can I get there? I want to be there. And so it was this propaganda idea that America was heaven, you know, to anybody. America would see you, take you, and change your life. It was also a kind of a self-hatred about your own past, too, and a shameless that we can't do for ourselves. We got to get out of here to get done for ourselves. But I think that mentality is not as strong as it was then that it is now. I think we're seeing people who are beginning. I had a conference call with some brothers and sisters in Uganda. I asked them, I said, "What do you need? What kind of support can we give you from the United States?" They said, "We don't need any. We're going to do it ourselves. We're going to build. We got to start depending on ourselves more and more." So that attitude that kind of blew our mind then, that despite all the things you're seeing, despite all the propaganda you're reading, you still want to come. You still want to live in this kind of terrain. So I think the desperation and a sense of hopelessness that they can find results there, combined with this imagining of having a better life. In fact, the young men who were traveling from Ghana to Germany were saying, "This is the only way we can get a better life." So I think there's a tragedy in our thinking that we can't do for ourselves. And that's a plague. That's a disease that we need to find a way to cure, to rid ourselves. I've seen only a little few threads, because today in Africa, we're seeing the hands of not only NATO and the United States, but Russia and China and those forces that I think are playing a role in overthrowing governments to have them become the new puppets, the new rulers in China and Russia and so forth. So in Niger, in Mali, in Gabon, places like that, you'll see there's been a series in the last couple of years of coup d'etat that are taking place that are challenging the West. Are they offering anything different? And I think time will tell, but it seems like what is unfolding is that there's, unless we come up with our own resources and our own strengths and our own capacity, we're going to see ourselves locked between the West and the East. Which one is, you know, when it's art there, we're not looking at ourselves as being the solution. But I think it's a very complicated situation. I don't want to oversimplify it, because the time will tell what's really unfolding there. But to me, that mentality of white superiority has seeped in. But on the other hand, what I witnessed in Liberia is that even though millions and millions of dollars spent on radio shows, religious radio shows, missionary groups coming in, that on the surface, it seemed like they were Christian evangelists. But in the heart, the people in Africa, they still returned to their own roots when it needed cures, when it needed medicine, when it needed social understanding. So there's a way, it's a two-edged sword, so to speak, where on the surface, it looks like we are all going along with the missionaries' narrative. But in the real world, it's just superficial. It's not there in the hearts and minds of people, that they still cling to their native spirituality, their native consciousness, and that the facade and the money being spent on missionary is not going where it should be going, according to the people manipulating the funds and the desire to change people's minds and thoughts about spirituality and religion.
Well, your book, so you spent 3 years roughly in Africa, then you come back and you write about a former SNCC worker who you believe set you up to get caught by the FBI in Detroit. You go to court, and by advice of your attorney at Polk, you plead guilty to the federal offense of failure to appear in court. And then you read a statement into the record, a very long statement to the record to share with the court and officially why you did what you did, the injustice of what had happened to you.
Yes. Well, let me just correct you on one thing. We were in Africa about a year. We were in the United States and Canada about another year and a half. So I don't
know.
Two and a half years, maybe about a year we were spending in Africa or so. But yeah, the court that I was charged with bond jumping or skipping court or being a fugitive was a charge I was faced with. I was told by my attorneys that, you know, there's no win. The fact is there, you know, that they can look at each day in the calendar you were at and say, where were you? I could say, here. They say, well, you weren't here in the court. So just the objective fact that I was not present on the day of the court was enough to sentence me to 5 years in prison. And so that's the advice I got. So I said, well, let's do what we can, but I want to at least make a statement about all of this. I want to show you what was in our hearts and minds, that we were fighting for justice. We were fighting for radical change in our community and our society. And that's what's led us to where we are. And we'll continue to fight for such, because the lies and the brutality and the violence that have been holding us back all these centuries is still alive and strong until we do otherwise. So I don't have the statement, but I would encourage people to read the statement, because it's just as true as it was in 1971 as it is as 2023. And we have work to do. We got a cause to fight. We have urgency to take charge of our lives. The whole world is being threatened with destruction. Environmental change is causing oceans to rise and for droughts and floods to happen at the same time, for people to be displaced by the tens of millions of countries because of terrorism. And right here in our country, that fascism is taking its turn now, never seen at the level it's been seen today, with white supremacists, with gun violence in our neighborhood, with our history being torn out of educational system in the public schools. All these things that happen simultaneously, wherever we are, whatever role we have in our own lives, in our own community, in our own home, there's something we can do to change that, to speak to that, to address it, and to make sure in every way we can that we're trying to brighten up the corner where we are, to uplift our communities. So I'm just saying that we need to move forward today together. And I don't see how we can choose to be otherwise, because my days are numbered. Most of my life is behind me. Few of my days are ahead of me. So I'm looking at how can we make use of the time for lifting up the young people, to be in the wind beneath their wings, to help lift up this new emerging leadership to be on course. How can I play a role in bettering my community? How can I play a role in changing the policies in my city, in my local community, in my county, in my state, in my country. So I think we all have a lot to work. Whatever gifts we've been given, whatever role we play today, there's something we can do more. If we are pitying homeless people, if we are pooing because of our plight, feeling victimized, there's something we can do to look at becoming compassionate. We can move from being compassionate to becoming in solidarity with others, from being allies to being accomplices for change. So wherever we are, whatever we're doing, I think we need to reflect in ourselves, to look inside, to say to ourselves, what can I be doing now to make sure that my children and my children's children have a better world to go through, to live? And I think it's a luxury to say we got time to figure it out. I think we need to take the moment we have now and exert ourselves more. But after reflecting, after meditating, after reimagining our society in a different way, let's see what we can do to make it a better place.
Ernest McMillan, it's really been an honor to interview you, author of the memoir Standing, One Man's Odyssey Through the Turbulent 60s. Look forward to seeing you at the Texas Book Festival. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Brother Hopton, thank you so much. I appreciate all the work you're doing. Continued blessing.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.